to Thriving Together, Stories from CCEJ, a podcast from the California Conference for Equality and Justice. Our mission is to educate and empower youth and adults to lead change for equity and justice in our communities. I'm Daniel Solis, your host. In many communities across the United States, there are intense battles over efforts to provide training and learning for workplaces that challenge inequities like racism or sexism. These trainings, often referred to as diversity, equity, accessibility, and inclusion, or DEAI, are an important part of making companies and organizations places where people of all identities and experiences can thrive. In this episode, CCJ staff Vanessa Rodriguez interviews our Executive Director, Rena Hajat-Carroll, and Executive Director of Groundswell, Allison Edwards, about the landscape of DEAI training in the workplace. They discuss workplace culture, navigating conflict through restorative justice circles, and the importance of community building. Let's listen.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to our CCEJ podcast, Thriving Together, Stories from CCEJ. My name is Vanessa Rodriguez. I am CCEJ's Development Manager. And today we are joined by Ali Edwards of Groundswell and Rena Hajat-Carroll of CCEJ. Go ahead and introduce yourselves.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ali Edwards from Groundswell. It's great to be here.
Good morning. I'm Rena Hajat-Carroll, Executive Director of CCEJ. I'm really excited to spend time with Allison this morning.
So we are here today to talk about DEAI in the workplace and how it affects staff internally and also the general public externally. So we will get started with a check-in question, which is, when do you feel most supported in the workplace?
As an executive director, I think this answer is different for me in this role because I actually feel really supported by my team when they're willing to disagree with me. My mom used to say, I can't trust your yes if I can't trust your no. And so I appreciate when people take a risk and you know, say like, I'm going to push back on that, or I want to think about it from a different perspective. Just lets me know, one, that we're creating an environment where even though that's a risk, they're still willing to take it. And two, that they're not going to just, you know, agree with me for the sake of expediency. So I appreciate when people will disagree with me.
I love that, Allison, because it is certainly something I've been thinking about, too, in terms of power and positional power with a role as an executive director. So certainly agreeing with that in terms of just having a balance of perspectives. The other way that I might answer that question in terms of support in the workplace, it is when my board members email me or verbally tell me that they are here to support. So simple, but it's so profound, and I think it has such impact on me when I know that they are, one, saying it, but two, that they really, really mean it.
Yeah, it's so wonderful when you have board members who are ready to be thought partners, and just even that continued expression of like, we're in this together is a nice feeling, because you can sometimes feel like you're alone. So that kind of affirmation is really helpful.
How has your organization communicated its commitment to DEAI internally to staff and board and externally to the communities you serve and the general public?
Vanessa, thank you so much for the question. The DEAI space, it's changed so many times over the years and the decades. Diversity, equity, accessibility, inclusion, belonging, I know is sometimes in there. It is such a fascinating arena and I think incredibly complex. But for us at CCJ, a few of the things that we do to really promote our commitment and show our commitment to DEI starts with pay equity, starts with inclusion of staff voices in things like our employee handbook. So we do a survey every year asking staff to give us input on policies that maybe they agree or disagree with. And then we look at those and we try to figure out, can we operationalize? Can we make changes? And that's a really important piece, I think, of inclusion for us. It's getting staff voices in sort of every piece of the business of the nonprofit.
Yeah, similarly at Groundswell, you know, we are both organizations that have some of this baked into our mission, you know, so it's not a surprise that we would be pursuing this, but how do you signal that it's not just in your mission, but it's in your culture. We try to find places where we can share power. Sometimes we do that well. Sometimes it's, you know, like you said, it's complex, but we try to find places where, like, hey, where does staff need anonymity to give feedback on this? Where do we want to have more of a open dialogue space so we can ideate together? But really thinking about the times when we can do with from our restorative justice roots, you know, where are the times when we realized maybe we've gone too far down this decision-making process without including enough voices or sharing in the decision-making? I think, you know, of course, looking at pay equity, but also what a pay equity with our in regards to our for-profit partners, right? Because sometimes in our nonprofit world, we can be equitable within our organization, but we can be like equally bad mm-hmm. to everyone because we have such a hard time sourcing all that funding. Mm-hmm. And that's uphill for us. And, you know, we just did a rebrand, and in that space, we talked a lot about belonging and co-creation and tried to make sure that we continue to use that language. We've even tried to see, like, what do restorative practices in human resources look like? Can we rewrite what some of those steps are away from traditional progressive discipline practices to make them more restorative? There's a bunch of things probably that I could say, but I think it does come back to that holistic approach that you described, Rena, of getting staff really engaged in creating the culture.
I so love that you brought up your name change and the rebrand, as you used to be OC Human Relations for decades, right?
Yeah.
And so I love the innovation behind the rebrand. It is something that has inspired CCEJ for sure. We are hopefully going to go down that path, and so we'll be looking to you for lots of guidance and advice and things that you learned along the way.
Yeah, it was an experience, so I'd be happy to share any of it with you.
So how would you say that you foster a culture that encourages open dialogue and understanding around these initiatives?
I like to say we can't get anything done unless we're sitting in a circle. So lots of using those practices. We've always, even before we knew what restorative justice was, we did a lot of work in dialogue. We did a lot of work in bringing stakeholders together with the assumption that they had the assets in the room already that were needed to address an issue, resolve a conflict. So keeping that as part of our practice has been important so that there's, you know, everyone has opportunity to participate. We talk about trying to be human-centered. So that could be kind of like an evolution of things like work-life balance, but particularly as our work environment has stayed hybrid. And a number of our staff report to a physical location that is not our office for their work, like a school site or a courtroom. Mm-hmm. You know, we had to do a lot to make sure that we were hearing from folks what's working and even course correct around that, because we actually had people, we offered so much flexibility that we had other people saying, well, now I'm just really lonely. Like, I don't connect with my coworkers. The innovation space is not what it was when you have to make an appointment to have a quick chat that you would have had because you walked down the hall when your moment of inspiration hit. So I think, you know, staying open to lots of change has been important to us. And then I think I said earlier, like, providing spaces that can be anonymous, like letting people have voice that lowers the risk for them as much as possible, whether that risk is something I may perceive it's not a risk for my position, but whether it is or not, like, how can we make sure we're responsive to that and that we don't just hear the same voices all the time.
Yeah, absolutely agree with all of that. And I think for us at CCJ, the other piece is for fostering dialogue around some of these really complicated and just tough issues is it is like a continual practice and a reminder of how important it is to be in direct communication and to really be head on with conflict. And I know it is something that I've been on a journey with. I am typically conflict averse, And so, you know, I think typically something will come up and I'll sit on it, I'll think about it, and maybe a year or even 2 years will go by and I will have never said anything about that. And so, you know, I think it is the reminders from other staff saying, hey, it's okay to address the conflict. It's okay to be in direct communication when something happens. Let's address it right now, right? Versus let's just sit and have this stew. And so I think that has been a really important piece of creating this environment where it's okay. It's okay to give feedback. It's okay to receive that feedback, even when it sometimes is a little tough to read or see or to think through. But I think this is the way that we're really saying it's okay. Inclusion is so much about the whole self, right? It is the whole being, the whole staff person. It's not just the thing that they're hired to do, but it's also their perspective on what we should have for lunch, which is a small thing, but, you know, to bigger things like our name, or, you know, if we do the rebrand, it's about office hours, working hybrid or not, right? Like, I think all of these pieces are so important, and I think when you've got several people with lots of different perspectives, you're, of course, going to have some sort of conflict, maybe a low-level conflict, but it's still, there's something that's going to happen, and so then it's just how do you work through that in a way that's respectful and, again, really inclusive.
Yeah, and you know, something you said made me think too of like building in that infrastructure. So even today, we did a quick check-in question. So repeating those best practices around when we get together, we have certain structures and they allow for that. And also in my role, so I can tell a story that I've told before, but I had a conflict in the organization that I contributed to unwittingly. And I had staff that was able to call me into a restorative process. And they even organized that. I thought it was a great process. I hope they agree. I was able to own where I contributed to the harm that was caused. And I was so appreciative of that. And without sharing the details or even the personnel involved, I went to share that back with our staff and our board. To say, look, this folks did this. I got called into the process. I'm grateful for it. And I just wanted it to be, first of all, to people to know that I tried my best to take responsibility for something in that way. But also, look, there's structures, there's things that we can do that you can call upon. And if you're willing to, I'm here for that. And so not only doing it, but telling the story and hopefully continuing that cycle of reinforcing that we have these great tools. Because we, too, we're all trained as mediators. Many of us are trained in restorative justice. And we're so conflict-averse as individuals, right? But if we call in on our values, like we have the do with value, we have a value around approaching with curiosity, and we've really kind of trained each other that it's okay to say things like, here's what I heard. Is that what you meant? You know, that's not a skill I had. It's not a skill I had even from our own original trainings. But I'm so thankful that the staff kind of guides and reinforces and leads that. But now it's like baked into our infrastructure. It's not just like, oh, I'm going to be brave today. It's like, I'm going to use tools that people are familiar with already and that we're asking others in the community to use. So it's not a big reach to ask ourselves to use them too.
So grateful hearing about your story of owning. That is a very similar experience that we had just a few months ago here at CCJ when our staff came to us and said, hey, why have we not talked about Israel and Gaza and Palestine? We as an organization are training around this. We're facilitating dialogues, but we as a staff have not talked about it. And it was a really, really, I think, beautiful moment where staff could share their thoughts and their frustrations around the lack of dialogue. And it was a moment in time where I, too, was able to own the fact that I didn't have the capacity. Mm. I personally didn't have the capacity to have the conversation because our worlds have been so busy with a number of things after October 7th. Mm-hmm. And it's been so much outreach to whether they may be board members or donors or just external constituents, that there was so much going on in terms of navigating the outside world that I think the inside world of CCJ did get neglected for that moment. And so we had a staff meeting where I owned it and said, I'm sorry, we should have brought staff together to talk about this, to just be able to share frustrations and perspectives and as an organization, what is our stance and what mm-hmm. are we going to be doing, mm-hmm. right? Like all mm-hmm. of that strategizing. And I think being able to model as leaders of an organization that, hey, we mess up too, right? We are human mm-hmm. and we are maybe don't have sometimes the foresight or just aren't thinking through because there is so much going on, right? But like the reminder of like, it's okay to pause. It's okay mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. our staff to hold mm-hmm. us accountable in the way that you described, mm-hmm. I think is so, so precious. And I actually think that gets back to, Vanessa, your question about how you feel supported. It and Allison, what you said about, yeah, it's when staff are actually helping to mm-hmm, hold mm-hmm, hold us accountable mm-hmm, mm-hmm. to the things that we believe, but sometimes right. in practice, it does get a little blurred.
Yeah, and the work is not linear, right? So when you see your team practicing that culture, I think that's an indicator of some success there, right? Mm-hmm. That they believe in it enough to truly practice it when it's really uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. I heard you both mention a lot of stories around accountability internally. So my question is, have you experienced any resistance or backlash regarding DEI initiatives from external stakeholders, and how did you respond to those?
So we'd offer workshops and training and even some consulting in this space with any organization, institution. A lot of the folks that we're working with now are other nonprofits. So I would say not a ton of backlash and resistance, but fear. And, you know, especially in the nonprofit world, we're still fairly under-resourced as a rule. So no one is saying things like, oh, we have a bunch of time to work on this. Right? They're saying like, how can I, you know, what's efficient and meaningful is I think a question that's consistently asked. So trying to help people through what it could look like to prioritize this is definitely a process. In the larger world, if you will, we're in Orange County. That's our main service area, though we do work outside of the county. For sure, I'd say there are people that are worried about this. There's some backlash, there's some resistance. And I think our approach has been to kind of like demystify what this is. A lot of times what we're really talking about with people is like, hey, is there good communication in your organization? Do people trust each other? You know, and not how many hires do you have of in this, you know, column and in that, like what people think of as quotas and things like that. We don't work from like a handbook of here are the, if you do these things, you are now in, you know, good standing in this world. It's much more of kind of like a framework or a lens that we want to create. So taking people out of that fear of, you know, that you have to understand every issue, or even that there's a right or perfect way to do it, or that it has to be political, or that you have to do it our way. I mean, all of those things. A lot of organizations are just getting started, and we're happy to have them just get started. And just kind of be thinking about, do you even have goals around this? Like, what would this look like for you if you thought you were doing it well? And just taking the fear out has been what has worked best for us so far, because it's most of this is done better in relationships. So mm-hmm. we want to work with people over time. And when we do that and we can build some trust, then it's like the anxiety goes down.
Absolutely. And I think for us, we are seeing so much of those similar threads. The other way I would answer this question, though, Vanessa, is really around what we're seeing externally in terms of requests. You know, I think there's all these different touch points in the DEI history. We've, I think, both been doing this for probably at least 20 years. And so I'll go back a little bit to like 2012, 2013, when the corporate sort of giants came out with their DEI departments and data. PricewaterhouseCoopers, Procter & Gamble were some of the first that I remember seeing these reports. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. This is data about diversity work. And back then it was also even called multiculturalism, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, you know, I think on the collegiate level, it was anthropology and sociology. And then DEI sort of really started taking more of a hold. But then we saw data, we saw funding, we saw more requests. And then in 2014, right, this is when Black Lives Matter really took off with the shooting of Michael Brown. And then we would jump to 2020 and George Floyd, and we saw this huge increase. And now what we're seeing in terms of pushback and resistance is really a different volume of requests. We are also seeing lots of requests in nonprofits and schools. But outside of that, government and corporate, we are not seeing what we saw in 2020. And I think that's the pushback we're feeling on that external level. It's that there are different pressures. The climate is changing. Mm-hmm. And I think, though, overall, I'm not feeling super unhopeful. I think that being in this space for so long, one thing I've seen is that it really does ebb and flow. And that's not like an exciting place to be in, but I think it's the reality that in a couple years, right, we'll see DEI renamed as it has been mm-hmm. over the decades. Mm-hmm. And I think there may be new players and new terms and new ways to approach the work, but I don't think it's ever going to go away fully, right? The state of Florida can do what it's doing around banishing and certainly killing DEI, but I just don't think that that's where our humanity is right now. I think people have seen the fruits, and they have seen the joys of relationships and being in community with people who look different and sound different. And so I'm hopeful that the work over the last two decades is really going to resonate mm-hmm. for some mm-hmm. time.
Right. And I think, you know, that another metaphor for some of this is more like the pendulum swing. So in 2020, yeah, that summer we counted something like 120 calls for support us, how can we do this? Or our employees are telling us we should do this better. And then in the last couple of years, it's like it's kind of swung back politically mm-hmm. with the, you know, we used to say DEI is kind of the corporate version of this work. I'm not sure that feels, kind of light, you know, and here we are a couple of years later and it's been politicized and it's been sort of demonized, and now there's places where you don't even want to say DEI when we thought that was kind of maybe not as forceful as a term as we would have liked. So I agree with you, though. It's like at some point the pendulum sort of swings back to a place where the hyperbolic rhetoric has been now taken out of it from this like demonization space to just like this is letting people connect at work, to be human at work. I heard a consultant say this, and I'm sorry that I can't think of who to attribute it to right now, but it was like DEI is often just about giving people a great place to work so they can do great work. I think probably most people are like, yeah, I like a great place to work. So I think we're getting back to that place where people can think of this more as this is just like a good thing to do because we all want to work in those places and maybe take some of that sting out that the last couple of years, like the different attempts to subvert and push down DEI work have brought.
And I would say, you know, it is a good, important, and such a necessary thing to do in our work, right, especially around restorative justice, when we spend so much time talking and thinking about harm, right? If we don't do this work, we are really at risk of harming so many people. I was really, really upset this week hearing the news about what's happening in our national politics and our former president who was mocking our current president, right, because of his stutter. And the harm that does, not only in that very kind of specific interaction, but also in the world, right? And so, like, I think thinking through that piece for us is really, really important in terms of, like, we are not trying to create more people that are harmed that are then going to create even more people that are harmed, right? We want people who are healed, who are whole, who are full, who are going to be in the world with love and open arms and nothing else, right? And I know that that is not possible on a grand scale, but I think that is what drives us to make sure that this work isn't going to go away.
Right. And, you know, workplaces are like such a hopeful place for this because it's one of the places where, for the most part, lots of different people are still coming together. I mean, many of us don't go to our neighborhood school anymore. We, you know, we drive to our faith communities and we presumably spend lots of time with people that are like-minded. And by all means, we enjoy those spaces. We feel supported in those spaces. but there's a consequence of only spending time in like-minded places. So work, going to work is often, you know, one of those spots where we can still figure out, like, how are we going to bridge across these differences, whether it's because I don't like how you worked on a project or whether it's because we're from totally different backgrounds. So it's like DEI is that hopeful place that if we can do this in workplaces where people are like, I didn't necessarily come here to work with you, but I came here to work. Like, what are the other applications that we can see that cascading effect? So I think we have to definitely not give up on workspaces as important parts of our society, our culture, and how it contributes to then even how we choose the other places we go to and how we interact with the people that are there. From the supermarket, where we saw lots of conflict during COVID, to, you know, I have kids that play sports. So how we bridge across our differences with the other parents or the other caretakers or the, you know, whoever that may be. I think we're fortunate that we still have those workplaces where we can think about this and work through the challenges that are like really foundational to holding the fabric of a community together.
I heard you both speak a lot about the positive outcomes, but I just want to know, is there any additional positive outcomes aside from internally, you know, the trust, the making it a great place to do great work? I like that. But yeah, just if you wanted to speak to any other positive outcomes as a result of the DEI initiatives.
Well, I mean, there's always arguments around employee retention and things like that, which are kind of boring if you're not the person thinking about it all the time. But if you've ever had a great coworker, you know, that moved on, you know that feeling of, oh, you know, I can't believe this person, like, we'll never be able to find that same person. And, you know, people who have bought into the culture, they stay and they contribute to that. That's important. It's really hard to hold your culture as close when you have consistent turnover and things like that. So we're always trying to make our organization a place where people want to stay and grow, again, with varying degrees of success. But that is important to us. And then, you know, there's just also this sense that, I mean, I kind of said this before, but like, if we can do this here, we know that it can be replicated. So sometimes it's like we're our own laboratory for change and for transformation, and learning from that is an important part of how we make impact in the rest of the world.
For me, I think it's really about the positive outcome being focused on having people that are seen, heard, and understood for who they are and not have to live trauma or baggage of their past where maybe they were shamed for who they were or embarrassed about who they were, right? I know growing up, so my mom is from India, my dad's from Africa, both have accents. And I remember as like a elementary school, middle schooler, I never wanted my parents to speak in public spaces or to my friends' parents or at school events because they had this accent and that meant that they were different and I was different, right? And so I think that's some of the baggage that as kids and as young adults we have and we have to let go of, right? And if we can do this work together, I think it can, in terms of DEI, it's really about healing some of that, those inner child, right, traumas that we all have, whether it's about culture, race, accent, sexual orientation, right, any identity. And so I think that is an outcome that's super exciting.
Absolutely. Love to hear people say that they just feel like they can be themselves when they're at work, which means, you know, like you said, they weren't always able to do that. And that's an important hallmark of, yeah, hopefully time spent in any organization.
Now, I will have to say that when you talked about your kids, a funny thing came to mind that I also have some work to do in my own family with my kids. My 8-year-old son, who is also very, very into sports, I asked him the other day something like, okay, so how would you identify your race? And he's like, race? I love to race. Do you want to race right now? I'm like, no. Not physically run, right? And so I think it's also just a beautiful space for us as parents and for those of us who have families and extended family to have these conversations, which, again, I think didn't happen as much generations ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Navigating that with young people, I mean, as a professional, you often think, well, I can do this, or I'm modeling it. I got this. it's not infrequent to find out otherwise.
Right.
What advice would you give to other nonprofit leaders who may be facing or anticipating this fear of DEAI?
This is a hard question. Thank you for the question, but it is a hard one. But I think, you know, I would always start in the space of, what's the motivation? Why do you want to do this? Is it because you're getting pressure from a funder, from your board, from a donor? Is this staff driven? Is this something that the leader really believes in? And so really starting with like intention and motivation, and then to address the fear or the backlash, I think it's being realistic about, well, what could happen? What are the pros and cons? And then really going through so many of the things that Allison mentioned, the benefits are. And I think it is slow though, right? This is not going to happen overnight. And so I think it's pace is important with this. And it's okay if the person starts, but it actually takes 6 months to a year for any movement to happen. So that patience and grace is critical.
Yeah, absolutely. Knowing why and doing that level of intake is really important. But I think I said this earlier, you don't want to start your process with like, okay, well, we're committed to this, so let's have a staff dialogue about race today, you know? So going back to, does your team trust each other? How do they think the organization communicates? And starting more with, what would make kind of like a strong culture? What are, you know, and if you need to build trust, if you need to build communication, let's start there. Let's start with like, can you tolerate conflict in your organization? Can you tolerate like and hold tension? And those things are important no matter what organization you're in, no matter what your goals are around DEAI. So I think it's like not starting with this big kind of amorphous thing that some people think of as this work, but rather let's just break it down into kind of how you can start. And even if some of the DEI work might stall, I have rarely seen people say like, well, we don't think we want to communicate well. You know, we feel like trust is going to be problematic, you know, board members, whomever, funders. So if there's opportunity to just start talking about those kind of foundational pieces, that's one. The other thing that for me, at least in my role, I was like, when I get nervous about this stuff, I always have to remind myself, we said we were going to co-create. That means not only do I not have to have the answer, it means nobody really wants my answer, because it would subvert that commitment to co-creation. They want my contribution, but it shouldn't be the answer. Mm-hmm. And so if you're going to lead this in your organization, or you are the CEO or the ED, I think oftentimes it's like, hey, why don't we think about a process where you hear from people? What are, like, even the folks that are like resistant and have the backlash, like, tell me about where that's coming from. Like, what are your fears? What if it goes poorly? How do you envision that? What's that image? You know, well, what if it was a success? What would that look like? You know, and so just like pause, because you don't have to know. You don't have to like perfectly chart the course. And if you try to, you're probably not going to have a lot of buy-in anyway, because folks are going to feel like they have felt in bad DEI projects, which is like, be good to each other and do it now. You know, like it's this top down. So just taking time to breathe and be like, oh, let me just get the people around me and in the organization, give them lots of ways to contribute to this, hear what's important to them, hear what they already like about working here. You might have great things to build off of. And so I just take so much comfort in that in our organization, that it's like, I don't have to figure it all out. We can figure it all out, and it's our organization. We can figure it out in 6 months if that feels right. We can take a year. We can get rid of those like imagined limitations that we might put on ourselves.
I agree so much. And I was just thinking about communication as like such a key staple to this work. And I think one of the questions that I have asked quite frequently, and I think is so important, is around like, let's have a conversation about why you feel like affinity groups are an assault. Or why are you so offended if someone asks you to identify your pronouns? Like, let's really talk about where these these responses come from. And so maybe this is just about education, exposure, and just maybe some more dialogue that's about being real related to what's happening inside that is making you put up this wall to DEI. And that communication piece, I think, is just so important with this work.
Yeah, and our team that are, you know, far better at this than I, those who are out day-to-day working with all these different organizations and they're learning how to make this work in many ways, but they're so good about creating all this work as an invitation. So let's help you find where you can see yourself in this today. Maybe it's just one piece. Maybe it's the whole day. Maybe you're ready for the next thing. But maybe it's just this one nugget for you today, and that's okay. Because we're going to assume that we're probably going to see you again. Or even if we're not. I mean, we have some contracts where it's like, okay, we're going to do a 6-hour implicit bias training. We may never see those folks again. They may have been required to be there on occasion. So rather than contribute to their distaste of DEI, it's like, no, this is an invitation for you to see if you can see yourself in this today. Take the pieces that felt right. We would rather have like contributed to someone saying, okay, there was something in there today, rather than sort of this demand that you agree or you take everything whole cloth, even though you wish they would, you know, you want that so bad. So there's this constant calculation between what feels right, what feels authentic, what we believe in, what we feel just like in our core that we know to be true. And the less exciting part of what's the strategy in that moment, if folks are resistant, if they're fearful, and you, especially if you don't have a lot of time with them. I would say maybe not everyone would even agree with our approach, but as we have learned thus far, our approach has been more like we're willing to meet folks where they're at. We're willing to let you take whatever bit and piece you could see yourself in for that day and move forward with that bit and piece. It might leave us with some discomfort because we want to name all the things, you know, that's what we feel called to, but staying within that strategy, and it's a strategy that's evolved over time with experience. So I think for some organizations too, we may be a point of entry for them, but we may not be their final destination, right? They may move into, you know, people who have, we have lots of students, I'm sure you do too, over the years that we were their point of entry, but they moved on to work I want to really do advocacy. And I think policy work is what I need to do. And I'm going to move from this organization onto the one that's going to do that. And we have to kind of be able to say, that's appropriate. This is where our work is going to end. We are a port of entry for many people. And I think there's disappointment sometimes that we don't go the whole distance with them, right? They're like, no, you need to do this too. And so that's a tension that we hold, is kind of like, we think this is our lane, and that lane may change or evolve over time. But today, that's how I see it. You know, we have over 30 people in the organization. They may say, we don't agree with Allie, and that's okay too.
CCEJ's vision is of a world where people live free of oppression and thrive. So what does it look like, what does it feel like to you when we live in that world free of oppression and people are thriving?
I can start by just saying I think operationally what that means, and certainly with my ED hat on, it is that everyone who listens to this podcast is going to cacej.org or going to groundswell.org and signing up for trainings, coming to our open trainings, coming to our workshops, coming to our big convenings and big events that we have so that we can continue to do the education. I think whatever level you're at, like Allie was saying, so whether it's if you're at the one-on-one level or if you're at the 401 level, right, that you're using us as a resource because we're here, we exist, we've been here for decades. We have these incredible groups of staff who know this work, who do it so well, and we're here as a resource. So for me, it is about people using us as an organizational resource. And then personally, I would answer that question just by saying that world is when people really just, as I said before, show up as they are without any apology or negotiation.
Yeah, I think being able to be in any space as your whole self and bring your whole self is definitely an image that comes to mind for me too. When I first saw this question, I thought about, you know, in community organizing, there's always this story that you go into the neighborhood, right, and you have your outsider hat of, like, these are the important issues, and we're going to address all of them. And inevitably, the folks that you talk to say, but could you just fix the parking, right? You know, and you think, no, it's these major quality of life. We got to stop this, that, and the other. And it's inevitably, I will work with you when you can fix my day-to-day challenges, right? Show me that you can invest in what I think is important, and I'll invest in your work. So when I thought about that, this question, I thought about, you know what? A world free of oppression where everyone thrives, to me, it's like, it's a good night's sleep, mm-hmm. right? Because what would it look like if none of our nervous systems were trying to do all the daily calculations of what just happened there? Was that me? Was that you? Was that this larger system at play? Do I react? Do I not react? How do I react? What about my kid was with me? What did they see? What did they, you know, the constant calculations. All I could think about was, like, how different would life be if you just put your head on the pillow at the end of the day, assuming you have one, and you just were like, I am not frazzled mm-hmm. from that. Mm-hmm. And what if you could use all of that energy? Like, no one would be hungry, right? You know, like if we had all of our energy to just, like, not be parsing that or eat or outright dehumanizing one another, but we just really had a shared vision, I think the innovation, the creativity, all those things would be expressed in a way we probably can't imagine now. So short answer is a good night's sleep.
That is definitely what I'm going for tonight, because those good night's sleeps have been missing lately, but I think definitely something that we can all strive for. Thank you so much for sharing that.
That is all of the questions I have for you both. Thank you again so much for joining us, Rena and Allie of Groundswell. Final thoughts?
I just feel so honored to have been included. Thank you for thinking of me and our organization. We often call you all like a sister organization with a different sort of geographic area. So it feels wonderful to know that we can do this work together and support each other and keep working towards this vision of a world free of oppression. So thank you so much. I really appreciate being here.
100% agree. So excited about this collaboration, but also just future collaborations, because there is more than enough work for us to do. And I think we are really stronger together and excited for our organizations to continue to make the impact that we've been having.
Thank you so much to Rena and Allie for sharing their stories of challenges and successes as nonprofit executive directors leading DEI changes in workplaces. If you're interested in learning more about CCEJ's equity and justice training programs, visit our website at cacej.org. To learn more about Groundswell, formerly known as OC Human Relations, visit their website at wearegroundswell.org. Once again, I'm Daniel Solis. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to hear more stories of thriving together.